Welcome to Leadership, Transformation, and the Healthcare CEO with Paul DiVitale, a brand new podcast from PDV Health Consulting, sponsored by One Brooklyn Health. With a special introduction in every show by Larae Brown, CEO of One Brooklyn Health, we talk to New York's top healthcare CEOs as they share their stories on how they managed to drive their organizations through tough times, and also hear about the transformations they've experienced firsthand. Here's your host, Paul Vitale.
Hello, I'm Paul Vitale, President and CEO of PDV Health Consulting. Welcome to Leadership, Transformation, and the Healthcare CEO. As a leader in healthcare policy and operation, my career has encompassed acute, long-term, and outpatient care. I've had firsthand experience with home care, business development strategies, and mergers and acquisitions. In this podcast series, I'll be talking with some of the most extraordinary leaders in healthcare today. And the best part is, I get to share their insight and thoughts with you.
Today, you will be hearing from Dr. Mitchell Katz. Mitch is the president and CEO of Health and Hospitals, or H&H. H&H is our public healthcare system, and H&H has played a major role in New York City's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. I know a lot about H&H because I had the privilege of working for H&H for nearly 30 years. And so now I'll turn the program over to Paul and my friend Mitch.
Okay, welcome back. And we're here today with our guest, Dr. Mitch Katz, who's the CEO of the Health and Hospitals Corporation in New York, a good friend, a good colleague, a well-respected hospital executive. Welcome, Mitch. I'm glad to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. You know, one of the first questions I've been asking the CEOs is, how did you get to where you were? Because many of our listeners want to hear a little bit about your background. So if you can give us an overview of how you got to be a CEO of the largest public hospital system in the United States, I'm sure people would love to hear a little bit about it.
Well, thanks, Paul. If you woke me up out of a deep sleep and said, Mitch, what are you? I would say I'm a primary care doctor. That's how I identify, and I try very hard to run health and hospitals like a primary care doctor, meaning that I'm focused on what patients need. And they need many things, especially when they are low income, when they are uninsured, when they don't speak the dominant language, when they're dealing with family challenges, and they don't have transportation to get to their appointments. And I want to create systems that take care of them in the best way possible. I got involved as a public hospital doctor who wanted to make things better for my patients. I didn't want to be someone who constantly whined and said things were not good. I wanted to be someone who made care better. At the time that I began my career, it was the late 80s. I was an HIV/AIDS physician in San Francisco, and I got very much involved in the services provided through the Ryan White Care Act, which were services beyond medical services. So we were providing housing, food, translation, child care services, mental health and substance abuse services, because there was the recognition that without those services, medical care would not be useful to our patients. And so that was my training ground for seeing that it's not just about writing the prescription or giving the patient the appointment. It's about getting them to the appointment. It's about figuring out how they would have enough social support to take their medicines. It's about making sure there is an interpreter so that the doctor understands what's actually wrong with the person. And so I worked in San Francisco, ultimately running that two-hospital system for 13 years. I then went to Los Angeles County and ran their four-hospital system for 7 years. And I left Los Angeles only because I always wanted to be a public hospital doctor. And this amazing opening came in New York City that enabled me to continue my career as a public hospital doctor and at the same time take care of my elderly parents, who are longtime New York City residents, now 98 and almost 94.
Thank you, Mitch. That was really something. I'm just thinking in my mind about the first time we met. I was so anxious to meet with you and find out about possibly even me working at health and hospitals, because my values are really to work with that kind of a population. I always have, and I always will continue to. That's what I like to do the best. And so I met with you, and I never forget that day, because it seems like I connected with you, and I didn't expect the caring that I heard from you, because I didn't really know much about you. And it was pretty unbelievable to hear a doctor that wants to work with this population that has so many social disparities. And then we had our first dinner. Now, my next question is going to be, we were out to dinner together and we were chatting about the world and all the problems in healthcare. And you said to me, "I'm sorry, I have to leave right now. The car is coming." I said, "Oh, you have an appointment?" And you said, "Yes, I have to go meet a homeless man in a subway station." And I said, "Oh my gosh. So could you tell me that story? Because I thought that was just a phenomenal story." Now let's take a break to hear from our sponsor, One Brooklyn Health.
PDV Health Consulting's podcast, Leadership, Transformation, and the Healthcare CEO with Paul DiVitale, is made possible thanks to our sponsor, One Brooklyn Health. One Brooklyn Health is dedicated to providing high-quality, comprehensive healthcare to the communities they serve. Through a network of acute hospitals, community-based practices, long-term care facilities, and partnerships with local healthcare providers, One Brooklyn Health's patient-centered approach extends beyond medical care to enhance the health and wellness of their communities and their patients and families. Visit them online at onebrooklynhealth.org today.
So could you tell me that story? Because I thought that was just a phenomenal story. Do you remember it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, some of my best work in New York City, I think, was done in subway stations. So I'm very concerned about homeless, mentally ill people. If you look at the natural history of homeless people with mental illness living in the street, they have a mortality that I think would rival pancreatic cancer. Although people don't think of it that way. But if you look for those people 6 months later, a frightening proportion of them have passed. And so the work that I was doing at the time in the subway system was finding people who needed to be cared for, who were not getting the care that they needed, and bringing them to the hospital. And that's a scope of work that the city has continued. And I think it's very important to reach out to those who are troubled and may not be able themselves to access care, may not realize that they need care. I feel we have a special responsibility to the mentally ill.
Yeah. And you as a leader are just having your own employees understand what's the most important thing. Because if people's lives aren't in order, how can their healthcare be in order? And that's terrific. You know, we have just come through a very tough year, 2020, and we look back. And one of the things that I'd like to do with you today is to look back on some of the moments of 2020 that not only have you done a good job medically, but that have moved you in some way. And maybe it might even be a personal thing. Maybe it might be about your mom and dad or a patient or a family. But if you could just let us know how you, as a CEO, who probably have been under a tremendous amount of pressure this last year, just thought about, if you could think about some of the most moving and touching moments that you had.
Well, Paul, it was an incredible, harrowing year. I still think that we're still in the same year. I'm not going to say 2020 is over until the pandemic is behind us. It's, to me, it's like a dog year. It's 7 years because of all that has transpired. What happened to New York City last year at this time, you know, was something that none of us had ever seen before, nothing any of us had lived through. Even through the AIDS epidemic, which was so difficult, and I lost so many friends and work colleagues, but it didn't have the amazing pace, the speed, the devastation that COVID had. I mean, to give you, you know, some sense of what Health and Hospital did, on March 1, we had zero patients with COVID who were intubated. 6 weeks later, on April 13th, we had 960 patients with COVID who were intubated.
Wow.
We tripled the size of our ICU. And if you asked me, and Paul, you're an incredibly capable and experienced hospital administrator, if you and I were sitting down 2 years ago and said, "Hey, Paul, I want to triple the size of my ICUs," how long do you think that would take me to do?
You might have said a long time.
You know, well, okay, you need some planning work. You'll have to figure out the space and variety of approvals. Maybe you could get that done in 2 or 3 years. Well, we got it done in 6 weeks. Every night at, you know, usually around 11, I was on the phone with my hospital CEOs plotting, okay, so what unit are you opening tomorrow? How are we moving around patients? So that we're going to be able to accommodate them. I was, you know, moving ventilators with my supply team to be sure that there was always a ventilator, and there always was, but it was harrowing. There were times when it was very close, when we just got the ventilators to the hospitals because the hospitals were not evenly hit, and even during the period of time, it changed. So, for example, there were very few COVID patients in South Brooklyn at Coney Island Hospital at the beginning, but then there were a lot at the towards the end of the first wave. So I was constantly moving equipment so that nobody would run out, and always worried, what if we do run out? What if we run out of N95 masks? What if we run out of ventilators? What if we run out of dialysis machines? And that sense that people's lives were at stake, the patients that we care for, and also the lives of my own staff were at stake. People were working under incredible conditions of stress, under multiple masks, under multiple gowns, and also just watching the devastation to our patients. As doctors, nurses, we know that sometimes medical care will not succeed. And in fact, death is part of life. It's part of the life cycle. I think that most healthcare people can accept this. But we're talking about multiple people dying on one night, people coming into the hospital who were in their, you know, 30s and 40s, coming half dead as they entered through the hospital, needing to be, you know, ventilated, needing multiple medications to maintain their pressure. Nobody had ever seen this at this speed. Right, you could imagine one patient, two patients, but we were running into scenarios where 10, 15 patients would be intubated just in a few hours in an emergency room. We had never seen anything like that.
Unbelievable. And you know, Mitch, you've talked about your staff, and I, for a moment, I want to look back and talk about how you as a leader had to deal with your staff, and what kind of approach did you take with people who were stressed and frustrated? I remember when I was walking with Larae Brown, the CEO of One Brooklyn, we met a doctor in the hallway, and the doctor was right in the middle of the whole pandemic, really was very upset about a small little issue. And after we left, Larae, I think, said to me, or I said it to her, this isn't about the issue. This is about the stress that he's under. How did you as a leader deal with the stress that the employees were going through?
Well, there's both the direct concrete things, and then there are the deeper, you know, spiritual wounds. So mm-hmm. on the direct concrete things, we had to provide food. All of the restaurants around our hospitals were closed because of the pandemic. Besides, mm-hmm. people couldn't leave because they were working such long shifts. So we provided food for people. We needed to provide clothing and washing machines because people were afraid to go home in the same clothes that they had worked in for fear they would infect their families. We provided hotel rooms because people were not wanting to even live with their families for fear that they would infect them. We had to provide transportation because the subways were not running at the same frequency, and or people felt that it was too dangerous at that time to be able to take them. So we provided transportation for people. So we worked hard to deal with the objective things. The deeper wounds, of course, were spiritual. They mm-hmm. were from loss, you know, losing so many patients. They were from the sense of responsibility. I haven't done enough for my patients. Because, of course, given the numbers of seriously ill patients, none of us could do enough for our patients. There were too many of them. It was much more about having to triage and figure out what were the most important things to do for each patient in order to keep them alive. We did provide rooms for staff to meditate, to be able to find a safe place. We provided counselors to help them. On the administrative side, where I think it was equally important, I always tell people, the people who report to me, do what's right. Mm. It's in a pandemic that can be very important advice because many of the things that we had to do didn't fit with the rules, right? Mm-hmm. For example, there are rules on how many people should be in an emergency room, mm-hmm. right? There are rules about, you know, how far apart people should be in order to maintain confidentiality and privacy, mm-hmm. right? Things that we had no chance about being able to maintain. You know, rules about, you know, the approvals of space and where patients can be and not be. And what I would tell people, of course, is try to follow the rules, but above else, do what's right. Mm-hmm. And if something goes wrong and you've done what's right, then, you know, tell them that Mitch said to do it. And I will take whatever blame comes from that. But what I didn't want was people to, in addition to all the other things that they had to deal with, feel that they were responsible if we were not following the usual regulations about how to care for people.
Mm. Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. You know, I always tell my clients, you know, you need to TOIF in some situations. And they say to me, what does TOIF mean? I never heard that word. And I say it means think on your feet. Because there are certain situations, and that's what I would tell my students too when I did teaching, that you just don't know what's going to happen, how quickly it's going to happen, especially running a hospital, and how fast you have to react. So you do have to think on your feet. But the beautiful thing about what you just said, Mitch, was that they weren't going to get in trouble, that you were going to take responsibility for it. And that was an act of trust. And you know, and I know that, and all my clients know, high trust, high performance. high trust, high performance, low trust, low performance. By you saying that to them, that trust was high in you. And so that's a bravo. But more than that, Mitch, how did you deal with this yourself emotionally? I'm sure you were right in the front lines. I mean, I could see you actually with a gown and mask on taking care of patients. How did you deal with it?
Well, it certainly was a difficult time. And I mean, I think the biggest burdens that I felt were, you know, making the right decisions in times, as you were talking, Paul, in great uncertainty. And I'll tell you one sort of funny, sad moment. In order to deal with the uneven number of patients who came to our different hospitals, we had to transfer patients because especially the hospitals in Queens were hit very hard and there was only so much we could stretch. And at a certain point we needed to move the patients. So we did that. 1 week, we had two articles in prominent New York City publications. In one article, we were criticized for the fact that we did not move patients quickly enough and that because of that, hospitals became overwhelmed and patients did not do well. In the other article, they said that we moved too many patients because the patients, and this is absolutely true, were so sick. Right. They were in respiratory distress, and therefore many of them were not stable enough for transfer. And I felt in some way that perfectly captured the problem, right? In some way, both articles were correct. But here I am with my staff trying to make the right decisions, right? Trying to decide aware of the risks if I don't transfer patients, aware of the risks if I do transfer patients. Knowing both of those things, how do you, you know, make the best possible decision? And I feel like there were many moments throughout the crisis where, you know, the greatest stress was having to make a decision that you knew was high impact without having the information you would want or even the time to think carefully about it. We made many decisions. I think at the end, most of them were right. Some of them were not right. And I will always carry that with me, just like every doctor or nurse carries with them the times that they, you know, didn't make the right decision on behalf of a patient. And it's a very painful and stressful thing.
I can imagine. But my son's first grade teacher always would tell me, because I'd always be called into school, about how it can help my son a little bit more in his learning experience. And I would get a little bit angry with him because he wasn't really putting his all into it as a first grader. And the teacher really put me straight one day. And she said to me, "Mr. Vitale, let me tell you something. Mistakes are one thing, an opportunity to learn." And so the one thing that you have behind some of those mistakes, whenever you're feeling them, are maybe they were opportunities for you to learn something new that maybe the next time we would do differently. Can you just talk about one of those?
Yeah, well, just a comment, and then we can talk more about the examples. I think, Paul, that part of the trauma that many of us feel from that first wave is that, yes, we learned from our experiences, but patients were harmed. And that's hard to live with. And I think that's what many of my doctors and nurses feel, that, right, when you, as a doctor or a nurse or any kind of health professional, what you want to feel is that you gave the patient their best shot. Right. There are horrible illnesses. Alex Trebek and pancreatic cancer, right? The proof that even if you are, you know, able to access the best possible care, even if you are have a great attitude, you still might die of late stage 4 pancreatic cancer in about 9 months. It's just a very horrible cancer. What you want to feel is that you've given people your best. The problem with how many of us came out of the pandemic is that wasn't an option. We were past plan A. We were past plan B. We were, you know, how do we keep as many people alive as possible? How do we give everybody the best shot at it? It wasn't the usual, you know, what is every possible thing that I can do? And I think that's the burden that people carry with them from those early times.
Thank you for sharing from what I call your heart and not your brain, Mitch, because that's the best way to share. You know, let's move on a little bit to what's going on right now. We know we have Johnson & Johnson and Moderna, and we have Pfizer, and we have vaccines. How's it going with the vaccines with H&H, and where do you see the stumbling blocks, if there are any?
Well, let's start, you know, with the success. You know, the biggest success of the vaccines is their ability to prevent serious illness and death. Mm-hmm. And if you, the best place to see that benefit is with nursing home patients. So in wave one, 45% of the deaths were attributed to nursing homes, either patients or staff. Deaths and serious illnesses are down now among nursing home patients by more than 80% because of the successful vaccination efforts. So I feel very confident that the vaccines prevent the serious implications of COVID. Whether people will still continue to get sick may be, you know, something of our future, depending upon how successful we are at vaccinating the entire population, depending on variants and how sensitive the variants are to the vaccine. But I feel very optimistic that we have the right interventions for preventing serious hospitalizations and deaths, and that our world can return to normal, even if we recognize that there will still be a certain number of infections, still a certain number of cases. At this point, our hospitals are quite full. Unlike the first wave, when other patients who didn't have COVID were afraid to come to the hospital, we've been able to still take care of other patients in a safe way. And because patients know that, they're continuing to come. So our hospitals are quite filled now, even though in the second wave, we don't have nearly the high number of patients that we had in the first wave. Unlike the first wave, we still have large numbers of non-COVID patients. I look in the next few months, vaccine efforts are going well. We're providing vaccines at all our hospitals, at our federally qualified health centers. New York City has a large number of other vaccination sites. Every day, more and more people are vaccinated, which will, over time, change the dynamics and will result in us having fewer patients ill.
Mitch, there are a lot of people out there that I've spoken to, I would say it's getting a little better now, that say, I'm not taking the vaccine. What would you say to them?
Well, you know, first, anytime, and you know this, Paul, from your spiritual work, anytime you want to help people to change their minds, you have to start where they are. Right. You cannot say, what do you mean you don't want to take the vaccine? Haven't you read the science? Right. Let me tell you what the science says. Right. You have to understand what it is. The first question that I ask my own patients who say they don't want to take the vaccine is I say, well, tell me, is there anything that would make you more or less likely to take the vaccine? Right. Let me understand, you know, more about you. Right. Let me not first, you know, try to lecture you. And what you learn when you have open, non-judgmental conversations is there's a lot of concern about the speed at which the vaccines were developed, right? And, you know, even the naming, right, that the vaccines were developed under warp speed. Well, that kind of sounds like sci-fi, like maybe, you know, that's kind of dangerous, right? I don't know that I'd want to travel right now on warp speed. I don't even think that's a real thing. So what does this mean? And many people have fears about the previous federal administration, feel that they were hostile to people of color, to immigrants. And then they worry, well, if that administration developed this vaccine at warp speed, maybe it's designed to hurt me. So I think going to, you know, well, tell me more about it. Tell me what your feelings are. As opposed to first trying to change anyone's feelings. I think that few people I've talked to have said no, never. Most people are thinking about it. And mm-hmm. I think having others choose to take the vaccine, seeing that they're okay, I think if we see disease continue to drop, from COVID due to vaccine, that over time, more and more people will want to take it. Mm-hmm.
You know, to all my listeners today, you're listening to Mitch Katz, the president and chief executive officer of the Health and Hospital System, who happens to be, after listening to him, I think I want to make an appointment for him to be my primary care doctor, because I'd love to get an answer like that if I were a patient. Mitch is the person who has heart, and running the public hospital system is not an easy job. It's a job where there are a lot of financial challenges, a lot of patient challenges, a lot of medical challenges, and Mitch deals with them with grace and with a heart. And he's got a very smart brain, as you will know by his background, but he also has a wonderful heart. So, Mitch, if there's any last piece of advice you can give our listeners about anything that you've said today, people who maybe have had COVID, people who are long haulers, people who have lost a loved one, what is it that you'd like to say to them today?
Humans are social animals. We need company. We need connection. And part of what has made COVID so difficult is it's put us in a position where we are dealing with a devastating illness without the ability to comfort each other in the ways that humans should. And that this comes at a tremendous harm to us. It's the reason why overdose rates are up across our country. People are really suffering. And I think recognizing that enables us to be, you know, more compassionate and kinder to others. And whenever someone talks to me, whether it's at work or in my personal life, about someone who's being difficult, my standard response, you know, it's COVID. You got to give people a little extra latitude. Right. Mm-hmm. You can't judge them based on pre-COVID standards. People mm-hmm. are traumatized. You know, this is a moment where we need more compassion and more kindness. We have to give each other, you know, a little more room. And hopefully in a few more months, we'll be able to all be together again. We'll be able to hug one another. Mm-hmm. We'll be able to shake hands. And that return to human connection will heal us.
Mm, that's beautiful. So I want to say thank you to our guest today, Mitch Katz. And for any of you who want the website of H&H, you can look it up. It's the Health and Hospitals of New York. And that's Dr. Mitch Katz that you're hearing today from us. And we're so, so happy to have you. And we want to say thank you, to your leadership, to your staff, to your nurses, to your housekeepers, to everyone who has worked so tirelessly towards this during this pandemic. So thank you, Mitch, very much. It was a pleasure to have you with us and listening to you. And I wish you well, and I hope to see you soon and give you a hug. But for right now, I'll give you a virtual one. Have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. That was very sweet. I really appreciate you doing it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Leadership, Transformation, and the Healthcare CEO with Paul DiVitale. We hope you enjoyed it. Special thanks to One Brooklyn Health for supporting the show. And we hope you will too by giving us a positive rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want to learn more about the topic we discussed today, visit pdvhealth.com, where you'll find the show notes. The PDV Health Consulting Executive Team is proudly joined by world-renowned psychiatrist, Dr. Francine Cornos, along with top industry-leading experts, Susan Flix, Joan Marin, Dr. Frank Kwakye-Burko, Dr. Alan Abrams, Sam Heller, Andrew Anello, Dr. Lisa DeRoche, and Special Projects Manager, Afia Kwakye-Burko.